Hello. You have discovered the Felon File. Formerly known as the 542 and the Blue Podcast. FelonFile.com is a podcast exploration and discussion of law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and elsewhere. Felon File is hosted by Scott Lunsford, retired police detective, sergeant, author and researcher. The Shade of Blue stories for Felon File today. You may have noticed that many of Scott's Shade of Blue stories occur or involve locations in the Blue Ridge Mountains on the eastern coast of the United States. Today Scott is looking at some different Blue Mountains. The Blue Mountain Range of the Pacific Northwest in the northeastern part of Oregon. A story of a famous first policewoman to a story about a double murder. Committed by a child at a camp located in the deep Oregon woods. 2 hours from any help and assistance. Background music. Hard Boiled, hosted by Purple Planet. Scott, you're online.
Thank you, Victoria, for starting us out. Welcome back to A Felon File podcast. As Victoria said, deals with issues about crime and punishment, old cases, police issues, law enforcement matters, and other things of interest that I find interesting, and I hope you do too, that occur in the Appalachian Mountains and beyond the Appalachian Mountains, which is where we're going today. And we're coming to you again from the International Recording Studio at Scratch Ankle, North Carolina, located west of Asheville and east of Candler, North Carolina. Find us if you can. Also, as Victoria said, I am your host, Scott Lunsford. Now, you may have noticed that a lot of our Shade of Blue stories for Felon File occur or involve locations, like I said, in the Appalachian or in the Blue Ridge Mountains of the east coast of the United States. I have a lot of love for that area and a lot of love for the history in that area. And that's one of the reasons I focus a lot on that. But today we're looking at a different set of Blue Ridge Mountains. The Blue Mountain Range that is located in the Pacific Northwest, mostly in the northeastern part of Oregon. About a 15,000 square mile mountain range that runs deep into Washington State. The area may be one of the most geologically diverse parts of the state of Oregon, at least that's what I've read. The mountain ranges and valleys were home to Native Americans and indigenous peoples for thousands of years. The Blue Mountains were so named due to the color of the mountains when seen at a distance, very much like the Blue Ridge Mountains of the East Coast. Now, in the mid-1800s, the Blue Mountains were a major obstacle to settlers that were traveling on the Oregon Trail. And the last mountain range pioneers and settlers that they had to cross before reaching southeast Washington State were passing down the Columbia River Gorge to the end of the Oregon Trail. One bit of history that may not be well remembered, but really should be, that occurred in the state of Oregon, where our Shade of Blue story takes place. It happened April 1st, April Fool's Day of 1908. Portland, Oregon Mayor Harry Lane administrated the police oath to 48-year-old Lola Green Baldwin, the first woman hired under civil service rules in the United States as a full-time paid law enforcement officer. Born Lola Green, she started working as a teacher in New York State and later taught school in Nebraska. In 1884, she married a merchant, Lee Grand Baldwin, and took a job as a clerk in a public land office. Having a strong interest in women and children's welfare, and with the support of her husband, she volunteered at organizations working with women's needs, child welfare, and troubled juveniles. Detective Lola Baldwin supervised the officers of the Portland Police Department's Women's Protective Division from 1908 all the way to 1922. One of the first special victims police divisions in the nation, I imagine. She had a major impact on state and federal law enforcement and penology. She advised the Portland Vice Commission, worked with the city's Domestic Relations Court, and served as Oregon State's special agent for vice control. A very fantastic woman from all that I can read, and if you care to look up more information on her, I'm sure you're going to be pleasantly surprised at all the wonderful things that she did as a law enforcement officer, as a police officer, as a female police officer in her time. Now on to our main Shade of Blue story. Now, we've had a couple of podcasts on murders on the Appalachian Trail and some other camping locations. Most of these murders are generally committed by strangers. The victims didn't know the suspects or they had just recently met them. Today we're looking at an incident involving a 14-year-old foster child and his foster parents, a young man by the name of Dylan Dakota Easley. It seems that the system was involved with Dylan Easley almost from the beginning of his life. Records show that Easley's psychiatric problems began pretty much almost from birth. As he got older, he developed a history of dangerous and reckless behavior. He assaulted care providers physically and with weapons. While in facilities and group homes, Easley would organize the other children into groups or gangs and enlist them in gang-up attacks against care providers. While being taken places by care staff, for example, mental health appointments, doctor's appointments, to school, to court, whatever, he was known to jump from moving vehicles operating at highway speeds and surviving. Now, the Petries were a foster family, and they were unaware of Dylan's previous history, and they had been told, though, by a Mr. Robert Johnson, who worked for the Greater Oregon Behavioral Health Organization, G-O-B-H-I, an Oregon nonprofit that contracts with the state and the county to provide mental health treatment programs for and care for care and placement for juveniles. Johnson, the employee with his organization, they told the family, the Petrie family, that Easley would be a perfect fit with theirs because he was also interested in hunting, fishing, and the outdoors. Okay. The Petries accepted and agreed to help and to keep Easley for 3 months. But when the 3 months were over, behavioral health officials asked them to extend his stay with the hopes that perhaps maybe the Petries would eventually adopt Easley. Now, right from the get-go, after moving in, the boy broke the rules and was disrespectful to no end. Now, this was according to court documents that were filed later. Easley became more aggressive and difficult to deal with starting in December of 2012. And his bad behavior, this bad behavior continued to escalate right up until the night of the murders. Carletta Petrie alleged that Easley was taken on a hunting trip on the recommendation of one of the mental health employees that had originally set up the foster program for their family. She also testified that she had asked for respite care because of Easley's difficult behavior after that first 3 months. He had been suspended from Baker High School in September of 2013 after he had climbed into a tree and tried to make a bow and arrow on school grounds, apparently to shoot at people. She alleged that she was told that the Petries should take Easley on this upcoming hunting trip with them, saying it would be the best thing for him. Well, Easley had threatened that something bad would happen if they left him at home with their daughter while they went on this hunting trip. according to the complainant. And so the Petries, feeling they had no choice, agreed to take him along. Now, according to the complaint, the shooting happened shortly before midnight on October 2nd. The hunting party was a group of five men who always stayed at the same cabin in a deer hunting camp in the Blue Mountains. The group included Michael Petrie, 43 years old, the foster father, his uncle Kenneth, who was 64, and of course, 14-year-old foster child, Dylan Dakota Easley. Two other members of the deer hunting group were a Bob, who owned the cabin, and a Dennis, who was a family friend. During the night, Easley went outside to go to the bathroom. When Kenneth Gilliland went outside to also go to the bathroom, Easley fired a single round into Gilliland's forehead, killing him instantly. The other hunters were awoken by the gunshot and proceeded to investigate. Now, in the meantime, Easley had gone back into the cabin. Not knowing exactly what was going on, made the individuals in the cabin who were still there basically sitting ducks. Once inside, Easley fired at least two more rounds from the revolver he had taken. One shot hit his stepfather Petrie in the abdomen and exited through his back. Easley then ran from the cabin while the three others in the hunting party stayed behind. And they tried to help Petrie, and they tried to help the gentleman that was shot outside. Now, there was no phone service at the isolated cabin, and one of the group took a pickup truck and drove to Granite, Oregon, to get medical help and to call police and ask for help. Seeing this and seeing the truck leave and knowing help was soon coming, Easley took off running. He got away from the cabin with two guns, one being the pistol he had already shot two people with, and a long rifle. According to police reports and the court records, Easley accidentally shot himself in the right leg while running through the woods with one of the firearms he was carrying. Dylan couldn't stop the bleeding, and injured and bleeding, he felt he had no other choice but to return to the cabin for help with his injuries. One of the men overpowered Easley when he came back and was able to duct tape and strap him to a chair until help arrived, which took about 2 hours after the original shooting. By that time, Petrie had bled to death and the foster father was dead. After that 2 hours, when the friend had returned with three deputies and an ambulance crew, Dylan was taken to a hospital in Boise, Idaho. They were actually close to the state line. When he was released from the hospital, he was held in the juvenile section of the Northern Oregon Regional Correctional Facility. He ended up being charged with two counts of aggravated murder, this 14-year-old young man. The district attorney and his investigators worked to determine what drove Dylan to this murder. Yeah, Dylan had been in trouble before. The previous year, there had been allegations of a second-degree assault, physical harassment, and criminal mischief. The state, in those cases, declined to prosecute Dylan, who was 13 years old at the time. On June 11th of 2012, he once again was involved in a criminal mischief and an assault situation. Once more, the state declined to press charges. Two strikes, if you want to count them that way. In one year, Dylan had been accused of three counts of assault and four counts of physical harassment. The DA had refused to prosecute on any of the charges. Instead, Dylan was placed into foster care. Now, this doesn't count the times that he organized others and was involved in assaults at facilities that he was placed at where he assaulted and harmed other people, but no criminal charges or no police investigation was required or made. After they refused to prosecute on the earlier charges, Dylan was, of course, placed back into foster care system, and we know how that turned out. Michael Petrie and his wife had received special training, making them qualified as therapeutic and treatment foster parents. The training that they had received was designed to help foster parents respond to children's emotional and behavioral issues. In September of 2014, another hearing took place in Grant County Circuit Court to determine if Dylan, who was now 15 years old, should be tried as a juvenile or an adult. The defense stated that Dylan might have been 14-year-old at the time of the shooting, but he was actually more closer to 11 years old mentally. The defense won that argument and Dylan was tried as a juvenile. Once the decision had been made, the district attorney's options were somewhat limited. The DA was quoted in the media as saying, "The reality was that even if we went to trial for murder, the potential sentence would be the same either way." Now, if you've worked in law enforcement or the court system in some way, or mental health facilities in some way or manner, you know what that means. Be it good or bad, both sides begin to work on a deal. It was decided that Dylan would give his version of events from the night of the double homicide. He would plead guilty to two reduced charges of first-degree manslaughter. Those crimes, if he had been tried as an adult in Oregon, would have brought about a 20-year sentence to life. Now, on the stand in court, Dylan stated that when he went outside the first time, he claimed to have seen a wolf's eyes glowing in the dark, and that's what he fired at. And that's the direction that he shot at. These were the shots that killed Kenneth Gilliard. He then gave the same story regarding the shooting of his foster father. Even with the guilty plea, the prosecution just wasn't buying it, of course. Dylan said he was just firing into the dark. Well, the fact was he wasn't. He was actually firing into the lights of the cabin. Michael Petrie was coming down the stairs with the lights on to see what the gunshots were all about. During the sentencing hearing, family members were allowed to speak. Carletta Petrie, Michael's wife and Dylan's foster stepmom, said that she believed Dylan would have murdered everyone in the cabin if he could have. And according to court transcripts, she is described as telling Dylan from the stand, "I feel that you have no remorse. I believe that you are so broken that you cannot be fixed." When Dylan was given the chance to speak by the judge, he declined to. With that, Judge Pratt sentenced the juvenile, the teenager, to the only sentence possible under the circumstances and under the law. Dylan was to be held in custody until he turns 25. Essentially, that makes his prison sentence 10 years, 5 years for each killing. Dylan was also ordered to pay $11,650 to the State Crimes Victim Compensation Program, which I don't know how he's going to do. There are still unknowns in a lot of the equation of Dylan. Did the criminal justice system fail Dylan when they didn't hold him responsible for his actions for the assault and harassment charges previously? Should he have been charged with the more offenses that he had committed? Dylan showed signs of mental stability issues previously before the murders. Were there not issues to deal with when he was put into the foster system in the care of Michael and Carletta Petrie? How about that issue of Dylan having access to firearms? With his record of instability, a good idea? Probably not. In 2016, Dylan's foster mother and now widow filed a $9.2 million civil lawsuit against the agencies that directed the system that brought the three of them together. One of the defendants named is Mountain Valley Mental Health Programs Incorporated of Baker City. Carletta Petrie argued that Easley was taken on the hunting trip on the recommendation of this Doug Iswana, one of the mental health care people. Carletta Petrie argued that Easley was taken on the hunting trip on the recommendation of one of the staff members of the mental health organization. Now, did she win that lawsuit? I'm really not sure. I wasn't able to find anything in Oregon's court records yet detailing and telling the outcome of that particular lawsuit. But I did find where the bank had foreclosed on the home of Carletta Petrie in 2018. It's a sad, unfortunate story. A story outlining things that have happened many times. A couple with well-meaning plans to help others and to do some good in their small part of the world ends in the death of two and the damaging of others, families, and lives. Dylan Dakota Easley is currently serving his sentence in the McLaren Youth Correction Facility in Woodburn, Oregon. His tentative release date is December of 2024. What will happen then? Well, of course, the story will continue, but like all good stories, the ending is usually a surprise. Thank you for listening to this Shade of Blue story. I hope you found it of interest. If you have thoughts on this podcast and would like to share them, you can contact us through the felonfile.com webpage or send us an email directly at felonfile@gmail.com. If you would be interested in copies of my books, fiction, and nonfiction works, you can find them at amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. You can just go on and do a search for Rick Scott Lunsford, and they'll pop up. You can pick up also, going to felonfile.com, you can also pick up something from our stuff page. You can pick up a Felon File t-shirt or a coffee mug. And nothing says, leave me alone on a Monday morning, than drinking your morning coffee out of a Felon File coffee mug and wearing a Felon File Real Crime Podcast t-shirt on Monday morning at work. Now, if you've got a good idea for a Shade of Blue podcast story that others might find of interest, send us a message. We'd love to hear from you guys. You can also support Felon File Podcast by buying Victoria and myself a cup of coffee. The instructions on how to do that are located at the bottom of our websites. Thank you for listening. In the coming weeks, try your best to be safe and don't let the Shades of Blue stories that turn out in a negative way influence you or keep you from doing good things and helping others out when you have the opportunity. It's still the right thing to do for ourselves and our community. Victoria, go ahead and close out our podcast. Be sure to come back next 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here at Felon File, where we'll have another Shade of Blue story for you that I hope you will enjoy. Thanks again for listening. Bye, y'all.
You have been listening to the Felon File podcast with your host, Scott Lunsford. For more information on this podcast or Scott's books and writings, go to scottlunsfordauthor.com and felonfile.com. Scott can also be contacted at these web pages. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. 2-1-N